The ship is off course. The sails are battered and tattered. The reefs and the rocks are at hand, and no one's at the helm. Or worse, insane people are at the helm. You heard about Scott Ritter, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about Scott Ritter. Let's start, Larry, with Scott Ritter. Last night I talked with him, and he said that the government has seized his passport. He was going to Russia, to the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. But the State Department, these police officers, they said that they are following the orders of the State Department to seize his passport. What's your take on what has happened to Scott Ritter and why they're doing this, in your opinion?
Well, there are a number of things I could say. The first one, having just listened to Scott, is that this was an egregious abridgment of his rights as an American citizen and a violation of several constitutional amendments. First of all, it was Customs and Border Patrol. Second, they did not give him names, and he admits he forgot to ask for them. He was so shocked. I mean, he had the Petersburg conference on his mind, and that was going through his head, and he really was very much surprised by what was happening. I had this happen to me one time when I was going to Cuba, so I sympathized and empathized with what he was saying. They said, give us your passport. Do you have any other travel documents and such? No, I don't. This is my travel document. I'm an American citizen. Give us your passport. Didn't give him a receipt, which is mandatory under such circumstances. And didn't explain to him. And when he asked questions like who authorized this, they said the State Department. Who at the State Department? We don't know. Who at Customs and Border Patrol okayed it? We don't know. Who gave you your orders? We don't know. At that point, I think I would have said, okay, confiscate me. Take me to your leader. Take me to your boss. I want to see him right now. I want to see the detachment here at JFK because there is one there. I want to see that, and then I want to go higher. I'm going to go as high as I have to go. I'm going to go to Joe Biden if I need to. But Scott was sort of flummoxed by the whole thing. Totally wrong procedure. My son-in-law is a policeman. I've been through the procedures for this sort of thing with him 100 times. This is not what you do. This is not how you act. This is disgraceful for both Customs and Border Patrol and these agents. Remind me of the young FBI that came to my house that I told, if you're FBI, I'm Jesus Christ. Get out of my house. Because they were so illly dressed, so rampantly stupid, and didn't offer any ID until I really kind of forced it out of them. This is the American government today, I'm sad to say. This is the way we do things. And of course, Scott talked about the group that was formed with State Department attendance at the formation meeting in Kyiv by the Ukrainians to go after what they call, quote, information terrorists, unquote. And that includes, Scott was assuming, and I would too, since they use the word terrorist, not only jail time, confiscation of travel documents, as with him and such, but also killing you. And with the Ukrainians, I would say it absolutely includes killing you if they can get to you and it's opportune to do so. This is unbelievable that it's happening in the United States of America. I don't care who Ukraine is or what they are. It's unbelievable. It's what we're accusing Vladimir Putin of doing. I think what we're looking at here is, you know, people say, well, Scott is all for Russia. That's hogwash. Scott is telling the truth, as are Ray McGovern and a host of other former intelligence people who know what's going on. It's not a mystery what these Customs and Border Patrol did. Violation of every aspect of the Constitution protecting individual rights, including search and seizure, and also freedom of speech. How does Scott now, you know, how do I get my passport back? Blinken? Do I go to Blinken? Jeez, I'd fear I'd never see my passport again. How do I get my passport back? No numbers to call, no people to find, you know, other than the very top. This is insanity. Now, having been at the State Department and having fielded many, many complaints from American citizens about our passport service, I can sympathize with the fact that Americans sometimes don't like the arduous task they have to do in order to secure a passport, let alone get one if you lose yours or whatever. So it is a difficult process, but how to make it more difficult? Don't give the guy any redress except calling Anthony Blinken. No, you take, that's another constitutional violation. You take the right of a citizen away to travel when you pull that document. That's a violation of the Constitution. That Congress funded the very thing that was happening in Ukraine with its money that set up this group that pretty much put these draconian conditions on travels and on information terrorists, their term, makes them complicit and is a violation of the Constitution too. It's like passing an act to go after a single individual. You know, you can't do that, Congress, but I could say you can't do that about individual rights all day long today. And from Trump to Biden, there seems to be no limit to what they'll do to violate those rights.
Right now, they're officially saying that Ukrainians can attack Russia using the Western weapons. And how do you see this situation, Ron? How dangerous is the situation that the Biden administration is creating for all of us?
Very much, especially for Europe, but ultimately for us too. And let me just give you some examples. And this is not just military protocol. This is the rules of warfare, land warfare. If we train F-16 pilots in Poland, or train them in Hungary, or train them, we wouldn't do it in Hungary, train them in the Baltic states or whatever, they're legitimate targets. They are legitimate targets under the rules of war. That is to say, they're training to go to Ukraine and fight, drop bombs on, shoot airplanes down, whatever, of Russia. So you're in your perfect right to go after that training facility, that logistics facility, or whatever. Now, that pertains to all the countries, Germany, France, Poland, wherever. There are people being trained or equipment being readied or refueled or refurbished or whatever for the war in Ukraine. Russia has disregarded that to this point, but they were in their perfect right in terms of the rules of warfare to go after those facilities. And it would not be expanding the war to NATO, not in the strict sense of the law. They're going after facilities in those countries that are aiding and abetting the prosecution of war against them by the state of Ukraine. And that's legit. But look at what that opens up. If Putin were to do that, and so far he has more or less refrained from that, but he's in his perfect right to do that. And I dare say China, Iran, North Korea, the whole BRIC complex, maybe Turkey, maybe India would support him in this, whether it was at the international court or whatever. He's in his perfect right to go and bomb those facilities or in some other way destroy those facilities or try to in those NATO countries. We're just opening up Pandora's box here. And Joe Biden and Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken are stupid men. They are stupid men. They are walking this country and vassal states like England and Europe into a war, a much bigger, more dangerous war, a war that has every prospect eventually of leading to an exchange of nuclear weapons. This is just insanity. When I was talking to these mid-level bureaucrats today, I thought I would probably get, you know, a sort of a look of he's crazy on their face, at least some of them. No. I got head nods, you know, that they understand what this is about. They understand the difficulty and the danger, and they understand the lack of leadership, the lack of coherent, good leadership at the very top. And that's very frustrating for that level because you can't do anything about it. You either follow orders or you walk. Now, increasingly, people are walking, especially in the Foreign Service, but that's really a terrible situation, predicament to put these people in.
The question is, who's running the show in the United States behind the scene in this dangerous time that we're living?
That's a good question. I don't think it's old Joe completely. I think old Joe has got locked into a domestic political situation that he can't get out of. And every day that goes by, Trump launches some kind of campaign or some kind of barrage that frustrates him even more, because I think, you know, there's nothing like, I've watched this, I watched three presidents. There's nothing like a challenger for a second term in office gaining ground, or even appearing to do so, to put the fear of God in the incumbent. I watched George W. Bush, in part at least, go to war in Iraq so he would have a war behind him like his daddy did when he re-ran in 2004 and beat his daddy by being reelected, which he did. And the war was part of it. Americans do not like to abandon the commander-in-chief in time of war. And he knew that, and so did Karl Rove. And so I know some of that is driving Joe, but I've got to tell you, I thought Joe Biden, the Joe Biden that I knew over the years, had a little bit better conscience and a little bit better grasp of things than that, that he would walk us willingly and knowingly into a potential nuclear conflict, or even a region-wide war. Even if we were able to restrain the nuclear weapons, a region-wide war would be disastrous. That he would do that knowingly is beyond my comprehension.
We see that European leaders, Macron and you name it, Sunak, all of them, they don't seem to understand what's really at stake right now at this stage of war, and how close we are getting to a nuclear war, a major war for Europe. As you've mentioned before, the problem would be mainly Europe. Europe would be devastated if anything happens between NATO and Russia. At the same time, we're witnessing that they're talking about pulling NATO troops into Ukraine. The Daily Telegraph reported that NATO is drawing a plan to move US troops to Russia's border. When it comes to this type of mindset, in your opinion, what they're seeking, if they do that, let's assume they do that, what would be the outcome of these type of actions?
As I understand what you're talking about, their language is something like, we're opening up lanes, we're opening up troop access corridors for entering the conflict. Now, I can put two interpretations on that. One, they're trying to put pressure on Putin, and two, they're serious, or maybe both. If they go from the putting impressions or interpretations on Putin to influence a negotiating position at a peace conference, that's one thing. If they're really serious and they're going to move troops along those axes, even just up to the border and threaten, but certainly crossing the border, then they're insane, as I've said before. Then we're looking at a region-wide war. I'm going to use some language here, and I ask for forgiveness in advance. Some of Europe, much of Europe, Britain leading the way, has been on the U.S. tit for far too long. They suck that milk, and that milk becomes their blood, and they're living off that. And they're so afraid to let go of that tit. They're so afraid to say to America, you are acting not as an agent of order in the world, but as an agent of chaos. And right now, you're bringing that chaos to our backyard. We need to calm down. And if we don't calm down, our electorates need to throw us out and elect new governments, and consult the wisdom of the ages, if you will. We need to think about what we're doing here, because the ultimate outcome could be an exchange of nuclear weapons, over which we hope we would have some control, but probably won't have any. And that will set Europe and maybe the rest of the world back for decades, if not longer. This is a battleground that could rapidly turn into the end of civilization as we know it. And I'm not just saying that to hear myself saying it. I'm saying that we have forgotten what Russia and us and seven other nations, but principally Russia and the United States right now, have in our arsenals. We have enough weapons on submarines alone. Submarines alone. Don't count the ICBMs. Don't count the bombs in the bombers. Submarines alone, we have enough weapons to destroy the human race. And we're talking about setting up a situation in the heart of Europe to produce a nuclear exchange. You wouldn't even think we would have gotten to this point. I've been worried about accidents. I've been worried about fire on warning. I've been worried about first use. I've been worried about the Chinese building out their nuclear arsenal. Those aren't worries of mine anymore. My worries are the stupid, idiotic, incomprehensible leadership in the United States.
It would be amazing for Zelensky dragging the United States into this conflict and starting a major war. He's trying to do his best to drag the United States into this conflict, in my opinion. And it seems that he's achieving something on the battlefield.
You're asking me a question I simply can't answer anymore. I can throw out words like insanity, incomprehensible, domestic political politics, and so forth, but I can't really give you a substantive answer to that question anymore. He's a clown now. He is what he was before. He's a comic, but he's a very, very poor comic, and he's a clown. And why we are holding on to him, this business of Ritter and this group that Scott described, that they've set up with State Department complicity to label people information terrorists who are detracting from the Ukrainian war effort by their words and their gestures on media. That's what it's set up to do, to go after those people as if they were terrorists in the traditional sense of the term. I don't know what they're going to do in Guantanamo if they've got to put thousands of people down there in Guantanamo who will be information terrorists. But this is the kind of thing that takes me back to what I would call the old Ukraine, the Ukraine of corruption, the Ukraine of nothing but Nazi-like people. It takes me back to original reasons for Putin to be worried about his Russian citizens in Ukraine, if not other things too, because these people are history's bad people. They are history's killers. They are history's murderers. Just go back and look at World War II. Look at some of the things that were done by the Ukrainian partisans to everyone. They didn't care whether you were a Nazi, you were an ally, you were a Frenchman, you were a German, you were an Italian, whatever. All they wanted was your money and your teeth and your death. And if you had any women with you, they're women to rape. I mean, everybody knows that, but now everybody has colored Ukraine as if it's somehow different. And I'm sure there are lots of good people in Ukraine, some of whom have lost their lives fighting for their country. And there's not this overwhelming corruption that there was, for example, in the early 2000s when I was dealing with it. I didn't even want to deal with it. I told Powell, I don't want to have anything to do with these people. They're so corrupt, I can't see through it. It's insanity, one leader after another. And I thought Zelensky was going to be a breath of fresh air. But it turns out Zelensky is a bigger comedian than anything else. And yet he's turned himself into a deadly comedian and a comedian that's taken his country. I looked at the map today. I looked at the map and I looked at the drawing that had been very carefully done by some military people, actually in Germany. And I'm looking at it and I'm saying, holy mackerel, look at that. Look at what the Russians now have or threaten seriously, including Odessa. It's not but a month or two till Zelensky won't have much of Ukraine left at all in terms of importance of the areas that are going. And Putin will have not only the Russian enclaves that he was worried about under his control, complete control, but he will also have some more of Ukraine. All this can do is inexorably move further and further and further west. And why we can't see that, why Zelensky can't see that, and why he can't reach into that disaster and pull out some success, which would be a ceasefire and a peace treaty, which Putin has said again, Putin is making every effort to do press conferences and other things that essentially say, I don't want the whole of Ukraine. Let's talk. But let's talk with me present rather than going to Switzerland with a bunch of people that don't make any difference in the situation. we won't listen. I've got to say, as I said to these people today at George Washington University, I said, no one is listening. Not only does no one have any empathy, no one can, I said, don't think about that term in its, positive humanitarian sense. Think about it in this sense, military sense. You don't ever put yourself in the enemy's shoes. You don't ever know what he's thinking or want to know. This is the worst thing. We don't want to know what he's thinking. We don't listen to him. Well, you know, Lavrov has grown so irritated at it that he just spits venom now. And I don't blame Sergei at all. But Putin is still trying to say that he does not want Ukraine. He just wants a ceasefire. He wants a settlement. And he's going to dictate some of the terms of the settlement. And since he's won, he's probably going to dictate most of it, at least in terms of who gets what and where and such in the oblast that he's concerned about. We need to take him at his word on that and go to negotiations. I understand one reason why we don't want to go, because we have no diplomats who could do damn well to win anything. We lose everything at the negotiations. I realize that now. We have no one. Bill Burns should head the delegation. Bill Burns should be there and say, tell everybody else to go away. Blinken, go away. Sullivan, go away. Go away, Biden. I need to be given full latitude to negotiate, because there are no other diplomats in the American government. This is a tragic situation. We have come to the end of our rope in a most tragic way. And Ukraine is going to be the fire at the end of that rope if we're not careful. And as I said before, it could be a nuclear fire. And that's just, we've brought the whole of humanity into this disaster, if that's the case. The word on the street that I heard, which was so vivid and so accurate, was from one of the 3.6 billion, I'll say, out there now, who really hates our guts. The United States, regardless about what I thought or how I felt about this or that particular act, was in large part a force for order in the world. Now it is a force for chaos. An agent for chaos. That sums it up. And Biden, Blinken, and Sullivan are the orchestrators of the chaos.
In your opinion, with the current situation of NATO, if they get involved in a direct war with Russia, how capable is NATO against Russia?
Not very. I answered a congressman's question, two congressmen, a senator and a representative's question the other day in writing. And I said, be careful what you wish for, dudes. I didn't say dudes, but I said, be careful what you wish for. You are going to get a rare awakening. You're going to have to mobilize. And when you try to mobilize, you're going to find out you can't. And when you try to institute conscription, you're going to find out you can't. You're going to have more young people going to Canada or Mexico. Mexico now looks like a good place to go than you are enlisting. And don't think that you're going to get them to go off to Europe to defend Europeans in a foreign war a long way from home with the record, the track record you've established over the last 22, 23 years in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and so forth. Because now the propensity to serve in the armed forces amongst American young people is 9%, the lowest it's ever been. And you have no reserves to speak of because they were 33 and 40% short on recruitment. And they are at what we call level 4, level 5, unready in personnel, training, equipment, every category of readiness. You cannot mobilize. So what will you do? One of them was honest with me and said essentially, well, we'll come home from Europe and let the Europeans handle it. Well, what if it's nuclear by that time? What, we won't come home from Europe if it's nuclear. We'll use our nuclear weapons. In fact, I'm very worried we'd be the first to use them rather than the second, because when you go conventionally, when you open those corridors for pouring those forces through, you're going to find out the Russians eat those forces up quicker than you can pour them through. And you're also going to find out that their doctrine is true, that if you pour them through in a really operationally sound way, massed, let's say, in two prongs of attack or whatever, with everybody there, the Germans, the French, and everybody else, you might constitute a fairly formidable force initially. They'll hit it with tactical nuclear weapons. They have said they would. That's their doctrine. What are you going to do then? Well, I know what they're going to do. They're going to escalate. They're going to escalate. Now, they think, and they came back with this answer to me, No, then we're going to hit them with so many PGMs, so concentrated from so many airplanes and so many rockets and so many cannons and such that they're going to be devastated. And I'm going to say, where are you going to get those? Because we've used most of them in Ukraine and given a lot of them to Israel. So where are you going to get those? You're going to make them overnight? I'm sorry, you don't have the foundries. You don't have the ammunition places. You don't have the shipbuilding facilities. You don't have the workforce. You can't do any of this stuff. We're going to surround them with NATO's maritime force. A maritime force which operates and exercises together all the time and looks so wonderful and splendid and everything. But you go to war with that force and you will find out that you have 32 freaking nations, not one. And you're going to have a real problem because about 12 or 14 of them aren't going to put their ships to sea because they're scared. You know, this is crazy. This, I can't say it enough times. We need leadership so badly in Washington, and we need it tomorrow. Yesterday, not down the road, or we're going down a path that is irretrievably bad.
Yeah. Turkey just said that if NATO wants to attack Russia or involves in a direct conflict with Russia, they're not going to be part of any sort of operation against Russia. And
that's what I heard. In fact, a friend from Istanbul called me last night in the wee hours. And I haven't been able to recontact him, but he told me that Erdogan had said he was leaving NATO. And I went all through the media. I checked all the YouTube channels and everything else trying to find confirmation. I found one hint at it, but I came to the conclusion that he must have heard Erdogan making a speech somewhere because he said all sorts of things lately. And Erdogan probably pulled that back really quick if he actually said it. But it is something that could be in the wind. And I wouldn't blame Erdogan. Politically, domestically, he's losing it. Finally, he's losing his hold on the Turkish population. And so he's desperate to do things that'll get him back, and doing this sort of thing with respect to Israel, for example, that he's been doing, saying that Netanyahu is a slave driver or should be in hell and all these other things, Satan. They're politically oriented as much as anything else. And so would a statement that he's leaving NATO be, I think, but I'm not sure. I think you hit on something there. The fact that he's even hinted at it or let it out that they might be thinking about it is serious. We're taking the most competent land army in NATO out of NATO. And as you just hinted, I believe that even if he hadn't left NATO formally, that land army he would not make available for an attack on Russia. I could almost guarantee that. He will not make that land army available for an attack on Russia. So count the most powerful land army in NATO out. And I mean that, more powerful than the United States. Turkey's land army, because of its positioning, its equipment, and its training, is better than ours. So you take that out, what you got left? I can't imagine that the military in Ukraine isn't really, really agitating right now. I don't know how you would find out the genuine nature of it, but they've got to be saying something up the chain. And whether Zelensky is listening to it or not, or just turning it off, or it's being diluted by the level of leadership immediately between him and the military, I don't know. But you can't tell me that people on the front lines in Ukraine who are now defecting to the Russians at an alarming rate aren't fed up with this conflict. And that there aren't some middle-level leaders that aren't trying to get the word up that it needs to stop. It needs to be a ceasefire and then a peace conference. That must be happening. Otherwise, I have to declare all Ukrainians morons, and I'm not prepared to do that. So one of those things is true. They're either cutting it off or he's not listening. Or he's so frightened of what Washington might do if he is listening and devises some scheme to accommodate their concerns that he won't do it. And that just makes us more guilty.
The other sign that show Turkey is changing its attitude toward the East is we know that they wanted to join the European Union since 1999. And right now they're talking about, instead of being part of the EU, they want to be part of BRICS.
BRICS.
Yeah, that's changing everything, Larry. And it doesn't seem that in the West anybody's thinking what's going on right now.
Not paying any attention. No empathy again. No empathy for the other person's thinking. Were I Turkey and I was looking at history all the way back 3,000 years, and I was looking at, for example, the study out of Oxford that says from the Xinjiang province in China to Ankara, trade can be accomplished with anyone in that distance because every language is Turkic-based. Everyone can communicate enough to do trade in that band. That's unbelievable. And it was at one time what linked all of that in the greatest trade apparatus the world's ever seen. In terms of actual profit and production of wealth, it outstrips ours today. Outstrips everything in the world today. Bretton Woods, the whole thing. If you read Frankopan's book, The Silk Roads, A New World History, you understand that that was really probably in relative terms, the height of world civilization. Well, it's there latent right now. And the Chinese know that, I think. Some of the Chinese do. And the Turks know that to a certain extent. The guy who wrote the article, huge book about the linguistic capabilities of that belt, if you will, think Belt Road Initiative, essentially says, once someone recognizes that again and builds that out in the sense of modern economies, then you're going to have the center of the world again. The center of the world was not North America and Western Europe for a long, long time. It was Persia, the Eastern Roman and Western Roman empires and such. We're moving back, I think, slowly but surely into that kind of recognition of where the world's real commerce probably generated and should be again. China's taking advantage of that. And China was taking advantage of it at that time too, as you probably well know. And the medium of exchange was silk a lot of the time. Roman soldiers carried silk in their saddlebags, not gold. You don't want gold in your saddlebag. It was too damn heavy. So you carried silk and it was a medium of exchange. Same thing with other things that were lighter than gold or silver. They're now finding coinage all the way up in the Scandinavian countries that came from this time period. This is one of the things that Frankopan takes advantage of, the new archaeological finds in Scandinavia and elsewhere, to write his history. It's coming again. It's coming again, and it has all the language and economic and financial capabilities and the BRICS, inchoately at least, if not historically and intellectually, recognize this. The Chinese certainly do, intellectually and historically, and they're going to take advantage of that. Here's the interesting thing. Ukraine was going to be an entrepot in Europe for China. It was going to be the place sort of where the BRI ended and flooded out across Europe. You know, it's compromised that completely now, just completely. So look at Turkey and say, why aren't you going to be that, Turkey? Why aren't you going to be that entrepot? Why aren't you going to feed the EU its future rather than the EU feed you your future? And Erdogan's got to be thinking about that. He's not stupid. And there's some Turkish people that aren't stupid either. And they understand this historical reality and the wave of history that's washing over Central Asia again. We don't. I'll bet you there isn't a person in the Biden administration who can tell you anything about what I just said. I will bet you.
Biden is saying that U.S. forces would defend Taiwan in the event of an invasion.
And how? Please tell me, Mr. President, how? With nuclear weapons? That's the only thing that would give you a prayer.
When it comes to Ukraine, we totally understand that there is a long border between Ukraine and Poland and other countries that they can feed Ukraine to fight Russia. Right now, Taiwan, how are they going to do that to Taiwan?
We're going to build one of those bridges we built in the Mediterranean. they got washed away. I talked with one person today who's sort of an oceanographer with a specialty in the Mediterranean, and he told me, I told him what the currents are. I told him what the winds are. I told him what time of the year it is. I told him what the weather's usually like. Your pier will last maybe a week or two. Didn't listen to him. Now they're picking up pieces all along the southern Mediterranean coast, the northern African coast.
Larry, do you find the situation in Taiwan serious in your opinion? When you hear Biden says something like this, how serious is that in your opinion?
Today, I heard that there have been some conversations between Beijing and Taipei, and the new government has assured. I hope this is true. This is coming through people that I've learned to listen to, but they aren't necessarily always right. I hope that he's listening. I hope the new president and his parliament are listening to what's coming out of Beijing, because what's coming out of Beijing is not yet, I don't think, a threat. It comes with veiled threat behind it, of course. It always does. Comes the same way from us when we talk to people in the world. It's the nature of power. But I'm hearing that they're being responsive, and I'm pretty sure that the Kuomintang elements that oppose them in their legislature are probably doing the same kind of thing in a mellower way with regard to their opposition policies and their opposition talk. And so you've got that force working in Taiwan itself, and you got the force of Beijing working over the telephone, as it were, with the leaders in Taipei. And I think it's mellowing out a little bit. I hope. That's what I'm hearing anyway. That doesn't mean we won't step in and make a mess again. Speaker Johnson, for example, carrying an upside down US flag or whatever, going to Taipei and proclaiming Trump will be the new president and, wait and see if he won't defend you or whatever. That could happen any moment. We have idiots, insane people in the Congress as well as in the White House.
When it comes to the situation right now in Gaza, we've learned that Netanyahu is saying that he's willing to have some sort of ceasefire for 40 days, 45 days, and but they're not gonna take out their troops. He says that we have to accomplish our goals, our objectives. What are their objectives, in your opinion, at this particular moment? What they're seeking for in Gaza?
First, a little background. Netanyahu was playing his duplicitous game once again. That's about all he knows how to do is play duplicitous games by telling President Biden to get the pressure off of his neck that I'm for this peace agreement. Yes, I'm for it. He was telling the right wing in Likud, I'm never going to agree to this peace agreement. You understand that? So don't break my government up. Because he was coming very close to being ousted. And maybe even the ouster would be the right wing. It wouldn't be the mellow people, it'd be the hardest people of all that would be ousting him. Probably carrying him out on a chair that was equipped with electrodes. That's Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and the rest of that crew. He got caught, and he knew he would. I mean, this is Netanyahu. When he's duplicitous, he's always got a plan for when the duplicity is uncovered. So when it got uncovered by the right wing saying, we don't believe you, and my God, we've read this plan and we don't like it, and we'll break your government up if you agree to it. Then he said, suddenly, he wasn't in favor of the plan. And he let that leak back to Washington, so put Joe in consternation as well as his lackeys. And now he's caught there. And I think what he's decided to do is to make it look like he's doing both. But to do both less forthrightly, if you will, than he would otherwise. What does both mean? It means he's going to agree to the ceasefire, agree, of course, to hostage exchange and on his parameters, and maybe a few other little niceties in there. But at the same time, he's going to continue mercilessly bombing and raking Rafah to kill as many Palestinians as he possibly can, under the guise that he's killing Hamas, which he's probably not doing much at all now since they've all moved up to the north, where it's much more propitious for their activities. And he's going to think that he can get through this, and he can get through it in a way that kills as many Palestinians as possible, satisfies Joe Biden to get him off of his back, satisfies Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and others so they don't break up his coalition, and puts him in a position where he can absolutely refuse to have anybody in Gaza other than the IDF when it's all over. He's not going to have accomplished any of his objectives. Hamas will still be alive, vibrant, and doing its thing, maybe gone into rest and recuperation and re-equipping to wait for the next opportunity to attack. Second, he will not have killed all the Palestinians. There's still going to be a lot of them left, and there's only one place for them to live, and that's in Gaza, so he's got to do something. He can't just throw them out. I know he's been looking for all manner of people who would take them, states, other entities, please take these people. But I don't think he's found that many takers. And now he's completely occupied what's called the Philadelphia Quarter. So if Sisi were not Sisi, if he were not so embattled in his own country, if he were Mubarak, for example, before he was embattled, he'd already marched on him. He'd have cleared the Philadelphia zone and dared him to stay there or do anything else. So we've got a real convoluted situation in that region, but it's one that Netanyahu does not control. And so he doesn't know what's going to happen there on any given day or moment. I don't think any of his objectives will be accomplished. And how he's going to explain that to the right wing of the Likud group that he's allied with, and how he's going to explain what he has to do to make them seem to think that he's done it to Joe Biden is beyond me. I mean, this is going to take the master politician of master politicians to feed all of these lies, all these deceptions at the same time, and have no one around him putting pressure on him, politically or otherwise, figure it out. I don't see how he's going to do it, but he's a master at the duplicitous act, and he can keep several of them in the air at the same time. And I got to say this too. There is no one around Netanyahu with any moral or physical courage whatsoever. None. Yoav Gallant tried, others have tried, but there isn't. And one of the reasons, I don't think it's because they actually lack the courage as an element of their character, is they agree with him. They agree with him. Ultimately, you scratch them, they agree with him. Just as many, probably now, I think I saw the other day, it's down to about 60 or 70%, but still, most Israeli, Jewish Israeli citizens agree with what Netanyahu is doing. Bomb Rafa, kill them all. That's what they agree with.
Do you see any sort of escalation between Israel and Hezbollah?
That's Netanyahu's trump card, and I'm waiting to see it played. He's put it on the table, but he's not slapped it down hard. It's not part of his ante, if you will. He thinks that if he's in the last stage of his survival, he will widen the war and he will do it with Hezbollah. And that will cause the focus to momentarily, at least, come off of him and his crimes and go on how do we save Israel. And we'll do anything to save Israel. So now we're at war, not only with the Palestinians in Gaza, but with Hezbollah. And when that happens, Hezbollah will probably unleash everything it has, or most of it. And that's going to be devastating. You may have read that the people who are unseated from their homes and have been so for a long time from that enclave there where they're fearful of Hezbollah, 70,000, I think, or something like that, are really agitating and lobbying him almost on a weekly basis. They want to go home. They want to go back to their homes. Well, they can't because it's getting even more intense than it was. Well, he's orchestrating that intensity. And when it comes time for him to die, go to jail, get kicked out of office or whatever, his last card, he'll put it on the table and he'll go to war with Hezbollah.
Yeah.
That's the kind of individual we're dealing with. That's the man who has been leading Israel since he orchestrated the murder of Yitzhak Rabin with the full complicity. The full complicity of the United States of America.